Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to the third season of Hidden Growth Champions. I can't believe we are already in our third season. And this is the first episode in this new season. I wanted firstly to welcome Chai to the program. Chai, thank you for coming in. We're calling you in from a very rainy and gloomy Johannesburg office. You're on the other side of the planet. You're based in New Zealand. It's great to have you on our podcast. This is the first episode we're doing this season on the healthcare industry, and we're super excited to hear more about your insights and your observations about what is happening in this dynamic part of the industry. So thank you for being with us, and please tell us more about yourself.
Well, thank you, Sal. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to connect with you and for the opportunity to talk to you and your audience today. A little bit about myself. So I'm basically retired from permanent full-time employment. I trained as a chartered accountant. I spent the first third of my career in a international professional accountancy firm. And then my last two-thirds of my career was in healthcare. So in total, my career lasted just a little bit under 40 years. So the last 27, 28 years was in healthcare. So I started in the back office, keeping the books, as we say. But for some strange reason, my career took in a completely different direction. I got into hospital management, eventually became the chief executive of health organization, and then found my way into national roles and eventually ended my career as the most senior public servant in the healthcare in New Zealand and as the Director General of Health. So it's been a wonderful career, but I'm not quite finished. So now I spend my time thinking more deeply about three particular issues that I'm interested in. One is, well, what does the future of healthcare look like and how do we transition? Secondly is, what kind of leaders do we need to be able to make that transition? And thirdly, and that is the subject of our discussion today, is what are the better ways to look after our elderly? So that's what preoccupies me these days. And so over to you, Sal.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for that kind introduction. I mean, it certainly kind of came to mind for me as you were telling us more about how you started. Kind of, I wonder how youngsters these days, when we ask them 20, 30, 40 years down the road, will say how they started their career. I wonder if they'll use terms like back office, for example. And we'll have a similar trajectory to ours, or very, very different. But thank you for that. Really appreciate it. I thought perhaps let's kind of dive in and talk about the transition. And I'm really glad that you used the term transition, because it's exactly the term we use in our work. And it's a term often ascribed to personal journeys, to leadership journeys. And we're going to talk about leadership in a moment. But you're seeing a bigger transition, organizational transition, an industry in transition. So tell us a little bit more about what is the essence of this transition that you're currently seeing? What is driving it? What is it pulling it forward? And if you had to describe it to someone who is not in the midst of transition, what would you share with them?
So healthcare globally is, not many people is aware, healthcare globally is a massive sector. You know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's somewhere in the region of $8 trillion. Now, this is pre-COVID. So it is big business that deals with life and death. And for the better part of my career in healthcare, I've got a sense that when I first started in healthcare, there was a sense that what we are doing at that time was starting to feel like it's not fit for purpose anymore. And this is 30 years ago. And there has been ongoing conversation to say, I think that the nature of the demand for health services is changing. But the way that we provide or the way that we supply health services really is too slow to change. Now, that conversation was around 30 years ago. And in the intervening years, that conversation has really picked up. And it has really picked up mainly because that gap between the demand for health services and the ability of the health system to respond has really opened up. And it's opened up and has manifested itself in many different ways. So at a high level, it has opened up the question of equity of access and affordability and sustainability of how the health services is provided. And as the years go by, those questions become even more important. But the solutions has still thus far eluded most health systems. And it's not like people are clueless of what needs to be done. And I think that there has been a lot of brilliant people, thinkers and scholars that have thought quite deep and hard about what we need to do. And in a sense, the recipe for transition is easy. It's just that we need to find better cooks and chefs, you know. So that's kind of the big picture around why my sense of transition.
Mm. Just to expand on that a bit, I mean, it's interesting that you describe it as a shift in demand, which I suspect in the earlier days was picked up by few, not many, and how that cascaded itself through the system, through the healthcare system, into changes in how we supply. So there's a transformation of supply, not only of demand, taking place anymore, and the one starts to reinforce the other, as well as over time, and I think we've saw that through the pandemic more than any time in the last few decades, of a change in the broader system, a change in stakeholder expectation, and change in how we see the process of aging and how we want to interact with the system. So it's a fascinating transition that takes place on more than one level.
Yeah.
But I guess what just picking up on your last point there, when you speak about we're trying to figure out the how, what do you see are the biggest challenges? You know, so if the why is now recognized by the many, we're now three decades in to your earlier point, and what needs to change becomes a bit more in focus as the interplay between changes in demand, changes in supply, trying new ways of working, new channels. What is it in how we provide healthcare that the industry is finding most challenging?
Fundamentally, I think that if you watch healthcare, particularly towards the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, you watch other sectors changing, you know, like the music industry, the retail industry, you know, even the transport industry, and we're starting to embrace technology in quite a significant way, one. Secondly, those industries were also starting to understand the need to understand their customers, their clients, right? And those two things have eluded the healthcare system to date. So the healthcare system fundamentally still does not understand what it means to understand your customers or your consumers or the people who use the service. And secondly, the healthcare system has got a built-in DNA that actually is very resistant to embracing new technology until more recently, like COVID, which actually threatened some of the powers that control healthcare, that threatened their livelihood and even their personal safety. That actually then opened a very small window where technology was allowed to come to healthcare. And we can talk a little bit more about that later on. But people get very excited about that, thinking this must be the renaissance that we're all waiting for. I think not. I think that what's happening is the window is open, but I think that the people who have allowed it to open are desperately trying to control that window.
Yeah, it's one thing about transition that it's never in a straight line, right? And we found new curves and new infliction points that take place. I know we're going to speak about technology a little bit later, but
sure.
just for us to get a sense of how this transition is playing out. You know, if you think of an example of a healthcare provider, if you think of a hospital groups, for example, or other players in the ecosystem are responding, can you give us an example that might just bring it to life of how does this transition play out? Or what are the kind of decisions that leaders in the industry need to make, and particularly those that are closest to the customer, those that interact with a customer on a more regular basis, that either bring us closer to this transition state or hold us back into, yeah, go ahead.
So maybe at this point, let's now jump into the area of better care for the elderly. Mm. And that's quite a good example to use, right? Because if you were to look at most health system, one, they're very dominated by hospital care. Secondly, the burden on the health system will always be disproportionately focused on the elderly. Now, I say, and the health system understand that the this burden is building, but it's trying to respond by trying to keep doing the same things, except saying we need more resources, like bigger hospitals, more workforce, more technology, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So what the health system doesn't understand is when we look at the elderly population, the demographics of aging population, and when I look, for example, at my parents' generation, and these are people who are in their 80s and 90s and perhaps late 70s, right? They're elderly, and they have possibly surpassed their own parents in terms of being able to live so long. But they are very compliant and are very appreciative for whatever help and assistance that the health system can provide them. So they're very compliant consumers. So they don't make demands. They accept whatever is given to them, even when it doesn't suit them, right? And I think that's so. Therefore, whether it's in the hospital system, so in most health system, what's happening is that when in the last 2-3 weeks of a person's life, they become extremely unwell. And what happens is in most system, the families will try and take them and rush them by ambulance to hospital. And when they get to the hospital, everything possible is done to try and rescue them, right?
Yes.
And those 2-3 weeks are probably the most expensive expenditure on healthcare in that person's entire life. What is not asked is whether or not that person actually would benefit from that. Because 9 out of 10, the person is not responsive. The person don't have a say, right? And the people who do want to have a say are normally the children. And the children of that generation have different expectations of the health system. So they demand the health system to do everything possible to save the elderly parents, right? So between a heightened demand of the children and the health system with better technology and advances in science is able to do a lot more, it's the perfect storm in terms of doing things to an elderly person in the last 2-3 weeks in their life that actually not only does it not improve their outcome, it actually causes them a lot of harm, but no one, very few people talk about that, right? So stuff. So I think that there is a movement happening. It's been going on for a little while, but it started small, but it's getting momentum, which is, well, I think, and actually in a large part, it's actually led by very enlightened health professionals who are basically questioning whether they should keep doing these things. So they have started this dialogue and the movement that says perhaps we should be encouraging the elderly to have early conversation with us and with their family of what they would like happened when they become unwell. So this is the theory, the concept of advanced directive, right? So and it's a very uncomfortable thing, because it's trying to get your parents to talk to you about how they're going to die. So it's not something natural, but there's a growing sense for people in my generation to say we want to have that conversation with our children, because we really don't want what we're seeing happening to our parents to be happening to us. So that's kind of an example at one end of the spectrum of how the system works in acute. The other thing that I think how the system is slow to respond is failing to understand that there is a growing percentage of what I call the new elderly, people like me, right? Who, because of easy access to the internet and it's available, we have access to more information, right? So we actually then become much more an informed consumer, right? And the informed consumer wants to be, if you like, in charge of their journey rather than someone actually being in charge of their journey. And being in charge of their journey then basically says, so how do I want to age well, right? How do I want to live my life as I approach my late 50s, my 60s, and my early 70s, and even in my early 80s, right?
Yes.
So how do I want to age well? Where do I want to age well? What kind of, and I think that what's emerging from all this sort of stuff is the focus is less on, if you like, the science of healthcare, right? The medicine, you know, all the procedures and all the drugs we could get and so stuff. That conversation is steering away from that to say, well, we will come to that when we get to that stage, but I want to live my last 20 years in good health.
Mm.
It is, right? Now, I say that because the data is very clear. While people are generally living longer, they are also living more years in disability and in poor health. So the movement that I talk about is for people like my generation, I in my early 60s, is I actually want to take more responsibility that for things that I can do for myself, but I also want to look at who are the other people, who are the services that can be I can collaborate with, and that I can partner with, right? So that I can continue to live well, right? Live well has different interpretation as we travel to our 60s, 70s, and 80s, right?
Right.
But I think that the underlying principle of living well is not just about physical health or even mental health, but I think it's about the fact that the elderly person wants to preserve their independence, they want to preserve their dignity, and they want to preserve their integrity, and they want to have a sense that they are still contributing.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by living well. So when you think about that, and then you transport ourselves to how the healthcare system works today, the healthcare system struggles with this concept of the elderly person wanting to be independent, wanting to have their dignity and integrity, and want to have a sense of contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Because the healthcare system is so used to doing things to people, and whether it's at the hospital end or at the the age residential or the home support end. So those the current ethos is very much about we're gonna do things to you.
Mm. Chai, help us to get a sense of, you know, given that context, of how that is shifting the way leaders in the industry think and what kind of new directions they embark on. Because the more you speak, the more it made me think about, you know, if we think about health as an ecosystem, creating the best outcome for the ecosystem is different to simply optimizing my current performance, my current outcomes, whether I am the first line, you know, provider of health services, whether I play a different role in the ecosystem. It's a choice that we make, right? We recognize that the outcomes could be very different if we look at the ecosystem as a whole. Yeah. So what does it mean for leaders who are in the industry and who are now starting to challenge and ask themselves a very different set of questions?
Okay. I think that there are more enlightened leaders in the health system. And my instinct tells me that they are still operating in the periphery. Because the level of understanding that I talked about really still is occurring around in the fringes, right? So for those who are enlightened, this is how they will operate. They would say, I need to shift the paradigm of our care, right, from one where the relationship is I know better, I will do it to you, and I will provide the care to you, to how do I partner first with the consumer and the family? Secondly, who are the other people, who are the other providers that I can partner with, right? Because, and thirdly is, if I were to adopt a partnership model with the consumer and other partners, then my existing operating model needs to be radically changed, because the consumer and the new partners are not going to just simply come in and just accept the existing operating model. They want changes, right? So the enlightened leaders will understand the need for partnership, but also understand the need to change your operating model.
Yes.
Right? And when I use the word operating model, I use the more comprehensive interpretation, because there are different interpretation of operating model. And in my interpretation, there are 12 core elements that make up an operating model. And when I say they need to change their operating model, they need to change every single one of the 12 elements. It's not the appropriate time for me to actually go through all the 12, but needless to say, you know, it's the thing that goes on right now, right? And how they do things, right?
Mm.
Almost everything has to change. So I think that that's what's threatening to the existing leaders. But the enlightened one are more comfortable and embracing of the new ideas, the new partnership. They are more comfortable with exploring what those new ways of doing will look like with their new partners and with the consumers.
100%. Now, I do remember we said we're going to talk about the technology. So, you know, before we get to some of the other elements of the operating model, and I really love the way you said it when you spoke about exploring, because there is no guidebook here, right? There's no textbook that says the new operating model looks like this. But I want to spend a couple of minutes and do talk about the technology, because in many sectors, technology, particularly information technology, is seen as the solution. You know, when we speak to clients and people who we interact with in the venture capital industry, for example, a lot of money is going into health tech. And you almost get that sense that if we get the technology right, a lot of these changes will happen. But I'm hearing a somewhat different voice from you. So maybe tell us, you know, before we get to some of the other elements, tell us about, you know, what excites you the most about what technology can provide, or what's emerging that will allow us to have a different model of interacting or partnering, as you said, between healthcare providers and patients and their families.
Yeah. So we're in the 21st century, and whether you like it or don't like it, technology is actually going to be playing a key role, right? So when we come to a new way of thinking of how we look after the elderly, we need to look at technology first and foremost from the consumer's perspective. So the kind of technology from a consumer's perspective for the elderly needs to start from when they are still well, and what are the technology that they can invest in and consume that will help them to continue to live well. So the easiest of those things, types of example, is the explosion of all the smartwatches with all the wearables, right?
Yes.
They can help people measure their sleep pattern, you know, their basic health indicators, and, you know, their BMI level, et cetera, et cetera. So those are kind of common sense thing. But I think that the advanced technology, even for the consumer, will need to leapfrog the things we know about, the wearables and all sorts of stuff, to things like implantables, to things about the role of artificial intelligence and robotics, the role of genomics and the role of nanotechnology. I get pretty excited about that, because all the theme I talked about on technology, most people automatically think about that from a provider's perspective. I want to think about it first and foremost from the consumer's perspective, right? So I would expect that in my lifetime, Sal, that I would actually have a companion AI-empowered robotic assistance. Because in some sense, you think about it, we already have them in our lives, you know, through Siri and all those devices we talk to.
Mm.
And it's a very small leap from that thing towards some sort of a personal robotic assistance that will be offered to you.
Yes.
Say in 10, 20 years time, right? So, and then there's the whole integration about, and so this will be a not a dumb robot, but it will be one that is interactive, that actually more also as a companion, but also mm-hmm. has got all the technology in there that can help you to remind you to stay healthy.
Yes.
Right. And to be also be on constant alert around anything that might start to present itself as a hazard for your well-being, right? And to be able to anticipate those hazards before they turn into an event. So you see, most elderly, what happens is that there will be some sort of an event, like either a stroke or a fall or a heart attack. When you have an event like that, there are always indications well long before that you're heading down the direction. It's just mm-hmm. that our system at the moment is not real time and is not smart enough to be able to actually see the early warning signs.
Yes.
Right. So there's a one part technology, but then if you come from the provider side, so I'm gonna leapfrog to the provider side. So in a rest home in Japan, in Tokyo, in that rest home for the elderly, the last time I looked, that particular rest home has 20 different types of technology it used in looking after the elderly. And it goes to things that talk about robots, but it also includes things like exoskeleton for the staff to help them to lift the elderly so that one, they don't injure their own back, and two, they don't injure the elderly because they drop them. Right. So, and then of course, then there's all this technology that can take place, not just in age residential care, but think about the technology that someone supporting an elderly person at home can also bring, right, sort of stuff.
Yes.
And then there's all this technology that takes place in the hospital. Because, for example, I talk about genomics. I would think that in 10 years, 20 years' time, you know, if you have to go to the hospital because that's kind of the right place for you, right, they would know everything about you, including about the molecular you. They would know about not just your genome, they would know about all your other omics. So that when they are designing an intervention, it's not the current approach of hit and miss and averages that happens. Right? Mm. So the technology in caring for the elderly, I think, in that sort of future I talked about, will be very precise, extremely personal, and it will be less interventional, and it will be earlier. Right. And it will allow things to be done much closer to where you live, as opposed having to go to a tertiary hospital.
Yes. Now, Chai, you know, when you describe this kind of future, and you've already used examples in Japan, for example, where some of it is already reality, is already being practiced and explored and tested.
Yeah.
And I wonder, how would that look like in the many emerging countries, which very often have a different age profile, but as they get access to a bit of food, a bit of primary health care provision, that changes. You know, how does the care for the elderly, how might that change in those countries? Do you see something very similar, or do you think the model might look very differently when we start to talk about markets in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, for example?
So I think there is those places you talked about, right? I think they some of those countries, continents you talked about, they have a longer lead time before the silver tsunami makes landfall, right? Okay, so therefore I think the opportunity for them first is to look at what's happening in the developed countries that have got an aging population and not follow them, right? Because the thing that I worry most when I look at the Middle East or in Africa or in Southeast Asia is the developed country models are often seen by these places as best practice, right? Whereas I think that those places you talked about can leapfrog the existing model into something that the developed countries are trying to develop. You know, so people use the word leapfrog. I actually heard an interesting Indian politician say that India should not just copy what's happening in other developed countries. We shouldn't just be leapfrogging in terms of the way we think about healthcare. We should be pole vaulting. That's a very interesting concept, to pole vault.
It is.
It means you skip a couple of steps.
That's right.
Yeah. So that actually then comes back to the issue of leadership.
Mm.
Right. And leadership, I think, is a very human thing, right? Ultimately, it is the quality and the quantity of the quality leaders that will determine what happens. And, you know, I worry about that quite a lot.
Mm. I really love that term, kind of the pole vaulting rather than just leapfrogging. You know, it's something that we see in a number of industries, whether we think about the impact of fintechs on financial inclusion, you know, whether we think about, you know, the introduction of digital services to populations who were disconnected, not only underserved. It reminds me very much of the conversation that takes place there. So I guess with your last comment around, you know, you worry about leadership, you worry about how leaders are responding to this. If I had to ask you perhaps one of my final questions would be, you know, if you had to stand in front of young leaders, people who are at the beginning of their journey, who want to make a change in the healthcare sector, who are seeing the opportunity in caring for the elderly differently, of leapfrogging what already exists and is described to many as best practice, what would you want to say to them?
I would say, one, if you ever get the opportunity to get into any leadership role in healthcare, it is, one, a privilege. And it is a privilege that should not be squandered. And therefore, in not squandering that, they have to come to that leadership role with quite a different set of values, a very different set of skill, and a very different set of knowledge. But fundamentally, it has got to start with the value. So part of the things I do these days is I actually do talk to quite a few young people. And I, as a bit of a intellectual exercise, I do follow and actually support a few of these people. And we talk regularly about their aspiration to step into different levels of leadership. And we focused on, do they have the right values? And if they have the right values, one thing I did say to them, then you need to actually find the skills that can support those values, right? Mm. And then you say, what are the knowledge that is needed to complement the skills? Because the synergy between the values, the skills, and the knowledge need to be very strong, right? And then I would say to them, one of the most important thing, if you're able to actually make the connection between values, skills, and knowledge, then is the issue of courage.
Mm.
Courage to actually break the mold, courage to make an impact. Now, the way I say that to them is, when you want to do that, right, don't try and eat the elephant all in one go, right? Because you get so disheartened. So I said, but if you understand the connection between values, skills, and knowledge, and then the courage to use it, you start with yourself. You start with what you are, the domain of control that you have over, which starts with you. So if you're able to demonstrate, you're able to actually combine the value, the skills, and the knowledge, and actually use it with courage, you will make an impact. And as you make an impact, people will notice, and then you will find that your sphere of influence will grow. People will give you more responsibility.
Mm.
Now, this is where the challenge will come. As you are given more responsibility, your values must remain strong, but your skill and knowledge needs to grow. And as you climb the leadership journey, that skill and knowledge needs to be exponential. It's not a linear growth, right?
Mm.
And while the value should always remain constant, the capacity to be courageous need to grow.
Mm.
That's what I say to the young people. And I say to them, if you're starting to embrace this way of thinking. If you haven't actually come across a problem that you really think you're stepping outside your comfort zone, then you're not really executing those lessons well. Because if you are, if you're executing those lessons well, you should find yourself pushing yourself outside your comfort zone, and that's when you realize that's the potential for growth here.
Chai, this has been such a fascinating conversation, and you know, ending it on such a high and positive note. Thank you for making time today to speak to us. I have no doubt we will call you for a second conversation in the near future. We've just scratched the surface. There's so many wonderful dilemmas that you've raised with us, and that you gave us a glimpse into how leaders in the industry are beginning to tackle, or at least to think about. And I really love what you said about the young who are entering the industry and the kind of privilege to participate differently. So thank you again for making time, for being part of Hidden Growth Champions.
You're more than welcome. I look forward to our future conversation. Thank you, sir.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.